Today is Tuesday. It is the 28th of March, the year 2023. I'm Jim McPherson, and today I'll be reading from the front pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. Starting with a review of the photos on the front pages of these two morning newspapers, in the New York Times, above the fold and across four of the six columns, we have a large picture of a man who has two children. It looks to be very young girls in hand. There's one girl attached to his left hand, another girl attached to his right hand, and they are walking away from the camera. Walking toward the camera is a police officer. And the caption simply tells us that this is outside Woodmont Baptist Church on Monday, where students from the Covenant School were taken to be reunited with parents. And of course, this is associated with the headline, "Heavily Armed Assailant Kills Six at School in Nashville." Below that, over on the right, we have a picture of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu seated. Somebody else is next to him. There are lots of seats around him, but he seems to be the only one occupying a seat. The caption tells us that this is Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Parliament on Monday. And this runs under the lead story, which has the headline, "Netanyahu Delays Bid to Overhaul Judiciary as Turmoil Grips Israel." And then below that, we have a picture of destruction of a house. We're looking from one room into another room with debris on the floor, and the bathroom is in the distant end. And we can see when we look up that in both of these rooms, the rooms from which the picture is taken and the bathroom, there's no ceiling. Indeed, there is no roof. "It's going to take a lot," is the caption. In Rolling Fork, Mississippi, residents are struggling to pick up the pieces after tornadoes killed 13 people last week. On now to the front page of the Hartford Courant, where above the fold and across three of the four columns, we have a picture of the two U.S. senators from Connecticut examining a document. There's a woman in the background. The room in which they're doing this has wood-paneled walls. It's quite handsome. The caption tells us that this is U.S. Senators Chris Murphy and Richard Blumenthal, who look at the only known copy of the first issue of the Hartford Courant with Andrea Rapaz, Chief Curator of Collections at the Connecticut Historical Society Museum and Library, on Monday. And then below that, we have an actual picture of that first edition. "History is Important" is the headline. The subhead, "Connecticut Senators Announce $1 Million to Digitize Revolutionary-Era Documents." And then below that, we have a group picture of a parent, apparently with two young girls, both of them crying. That's in the foreground. In the background, we have another child and two more parents. "Children are escorted from a reunification center after a shooting at their school Monday in Nashville, Tennessee." That's the headline on this story. And as long as we're in the Hartford Courant, let's take a look at this lead story. "Authorities, attackers had a map of the building and had done surveillance." This article is by Jonathan Matisse and Travis Lawler of the Associated Press. It is datelined Nashville, Tennessee. "The suspect in a Nashville school shooting Monday had drawn a detailed map of the building, including potential entry points, and done surveillance before killing three students and three adults in the latest in a series of mass shootings in a country growing increasingly unnerved by bloodshed in schools. The suspect, who was killed by police, is believed to be a former student at the Covenant School in Nashville, where the shooting took place. The shooter was armed with two assault-style weapons, a rifle and a pistol, as well as a handgun," authorities said. At least two of them were believed to have been obtained legally in the Nashville area. The victims were identified as Evelyn Dykhouse, Haley Scruggs, and William McKinney, all 8 or 9 years of age, and Mike Hill, Catherine Kuntz, and Cynthia Peake, all 60 or 61 years of age. The website of the Covenant School, a Presbyterian school founded in 2001, lists a Catherine Kuntz as the head of the school. Her LinkedIn profile says that she's led the school since July of 2016. The attack at the Covenant School, which has about 200 students from preschool through sixth grade, as well as roughly 50 staff members, comes as communities around the nation are reeling from a spate of school violence, including the massacre at an elementary school in Uvalde, Texas last year, a first grader who shot his teacher in Virginia, and a shooting last week in Denver that wounded two administrators. Quote, "I was literally moved to tears to see this and the kids as they were being ushered out of the building," unquote, Metropolitan Nashville Police Chief John Drake said at an afternoon news conference. Drake did not give a specific motive when asked by reporters, but gave chilling example of the shooter's prior planning for the targeted attack. Quote, "We have a manifesto, we have some writings that we're going over that pertain to this date, the actual incident," unquote, he said. Quoting again, "We have a map drawn out of how this was all going to take place," unquote. The Covenant School was founded as a ministry of Covenant Presbyterian Church, the affluent Green Hills neighborhood just south of downtown Nashville, where the Covenant School is located, is home to the famed Bluebird Cafe, a beloved spot for musicians and songwriters. President Joe Biden, speaking at an unrelated event Monday at the White House, called the shooting a, quote, "family's worst nightmare," unquote, and implored Congress again to pass a ban on certain semi-automatic weapons, quote, "It's ripping at the soul of this nation, ripping at the very soul of this nation," unquote, Biden said. Monday's tragedy unfolded over roughly 14 minutes. Police received the initial call about an active shooter at 10:13 a.m. Officers began clearing the first story of the school when they heard gunshots coming from the second level, police spokesman Don Aaron said during a news briefing. Two officers from a five-member team opened fire in response, fatally shooting the suspect at 10:27 a.m., Aaron said. One officer had a hand wound from cut glass. Aaron said there were no police officers present or assigned to the school at the time of the shooting because it is a church-run school. Other students walked to safety Monday, holding hands as they left their school, surrounded by police cars, to a nearby church to be reunited with their parents. Rachel Dibble, who was at the school as families found their children, described the scene as everyone being in, quote, "complete shock," unquote. Quoting again, "People were involuntarily trembling," unquote, said Dibble, whose children attend a different private school in Nashville. Quoting once more, "The children started their morning in their cute little uniforms. They probably had some Fruit Loops, and now their whole lives changed today," unquote. And now, from the front page of the New York Times, this is the lead headline. Netanyahu delays bid to overhaul Israel's judiciary as protests rage. The Israeli prime minister called for dialogue as civil unrest and work stoppages reached a crisis point, grinding the country to a halt. This article is by Patrick Kingsley, Isabel Kirshner, and Eric Nagorny. It is datelined Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Monday that he was delaying his government's campaign to exert greater control over the judiciary, backing off in the face of furious public protest that has plunged Israel into one of the deepest crises of its history. In recent weeks, Mr. Netanyahu had been unyielding in his pursuit of the court overhaul, even as protests drawing hundreds of thousands have erupted across the country. On Sunday, he fired his defense minister for even suggesting that the plan be delayed. But on Monday, with civil unrest at new heights, with work stoppages hitting hospitals, airports, and schools, and with dissent growing in the military, he relented, if only for the moment. Quote, "When there is a possibility of preventing a civil war through dialogue, I, as the prime minister, take a time out for dialogue," unquote, Mr. Netanyahu said in a speech announcing the postponement. The concession came as Itamar Ben-Gvir, the head of a powerful far-right political party in Mr. Netanyahu's governing coalition, said he was open to delaying a parliamentary vote on overhauling the judiciary, giving Mr. Netanyahu some breathing room as protests ground the country to a halt. By backing down, Mr. Netanyahu may be able to restore calm to the streets, but he now risks destabilizing the political coalition that he labored to assemble, finally forming a government in December. Many of his hard-right government partners had dug in their heels at any suggestion of a delayed vote. Even as he relented on the timing, Mr. Ben-Gvir made it clear that he was not giving up, quote, "the reform will pass," unquote, he declared, vowing that, quoting again, "no one will scare us," unquote. And it was unclear if Mr. Netanyahu's announcement would, in fact, appease opponents of the court plan. The Israeli opposition parties appeared to be split over his offer of dialogue. While Yair Lapid, a former prime minister and the centrist leader of the opposition, welcomed it, if warily, Merav Mikaeli, the head of the center-left Labor Party, rejected it. Quote, "How many more times can we fall into the trap of cooperating with Netanyahu," unquote, Ms. Mikaeli said, accusing him of, quote, "buying time at the expense of our democracy." From the World and Nation pages of the Hartford Courant, VP takes step to broaden U.S. outreach in West Africa. Harris pledges aid to Ghana's president amid rising concerns. This article is by Chris McGarrian and Sam Mednick of the Associated Press. It is datelined Accra, Ghana. With fears of terrorism and Russian mercenaries ripping through West Africa, Vice President Kamala Harris on Monday opened her week-long trip to the continent by vowing support for Ghana, a democratic pillar in the region that's being squeezed by an economic crisis and security concerns. The visit was a high-profile show of support for Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo, who faces rising discontent over inflation after previously overseeing one of the world's fast-growing economies. Quote, "Under your leadership, Ghana has been a beacon of democracy and a contributor to global peace and security," unquote, Harris said during a joint news conference at the Jubilee House, the presidential palace in Accra. Harris announced $100 million in assistance for the region and pledged that the United States would be, quote, "strengthening our partnerships across the continent of Africa," unquote. The administration also is requesting another $139 million from Congress to help Ghana reduce child labor, improve weather forecasting, support local musicians, and defend against disease outbreaks. Harris is the most notable member of President Joe Biden's administration to visit Africa this year, and she'll be continuing on to Tanzania and Zambia later this week. The trip is part of a concerted effort to broaden U.S. outreach at a time when China and Russia have entrenched interests of their own in Africa. Ghana and some other African countries are suffering ripple effects from the Russian invasion of Ukraine, such as higher costs for food and fuel. The war has also become a dividing line at the United Nations, where some African leaders have condemned the invasion and others have refused to do so. The situation has sparked alarm about the potential for a new Cold War dynamic, where global competition leaves Africa caught in the middle. Harris was careful to emphasize that the U.S. outreach was independent of geopolitical rivalries. Quote, "Yes, we are concerned with security. We are concerned with what is happening on the globe as a whole. We are clear-eyed about that," unquote, she said. Quoting once more, "But this trip is motivated by the importance of the direct relationship between the United States and Ghana, and as I travel the continent, with those countries as well," unquote. Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, who has worked extensively on African issues and joined Harris for the trip to Ghana, said that, quote, "it would be a tragic error to disrespect the legitimate hopes and interests of African people," unquote. The United States has sent troops to train militaries from Ghana and other countries in the hopes of bolstering their defenses against local offshoots of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. However, other countries have turned to the Russian mercenary force known as Wagner, which has been on the front lines of Russia's war in Ukraine, but also has a presence in Africa. Back to the New York Times for this headline. After doling out huge loans, China is now bailing out countries. Beijing is emerging as a new heavyweight in providing emergency funds to debt-ridden countries, catching up to the IMF as a lender of last resort. This article is by Keith Bradshaw. Since the end of World War II, the International Monetary Fund and the United States have been the world's lenders of last resort, each wielding broad influence over the global economy. Now, a new heavyweight has emerged in providing emergency loans to debt-ridden countries, China. New data shows that China is providing ever more emergency loans to countries, including Turkey, Argentina, and Sri Lanka. China has been helping countries that have either geopolitical significance, like a strategic location, or lots of natural resources. Many of them have been borrowing heavily from Beijing for years to pay for infrastructure and other projects. While China is not yet equal to the IMF, it is catching up fast, providing $240 billion of emergency financing in recent years. China gave $40.5 billion in such loans to distressed countries in 2021, according to a new study by American and European experts who drew statistics from Aid Data, a research institute at William & Mary, a university in Williamsburg, Virginia. China provided $10 billion in 2014 and none in 2010. By comparison, the IMF lent $68.6 billion to countries in financial distress in 2021, a pace that has stayed fairly steady in recent years, except for a jump in 2020 at the start of the pandemic. In many ways, China has replaced the United States in bailing out indebted low- and middle-income countries. The U.S. Treasury's last sizable rescue loan to a middle-income country was a $1.5 billion credit to Uruguay in 2002. The Federal Reserve still provides very short-term financing to other industrialized countries when they need extra dollars for a few days or weeks. China's emerging position as a lender of last resort reflects its evolving status as an economic superpower at a time of global weakness. Dozens of countries are struggling to pay their debts as a slowing economy and rising interest rates push many nations to the brink. And now, from the Hartford Courant's World and Nation pages, New York to pay $5.5 million after wrongful conviction in Siebold rape case. This from the Associated Press. It is Dateline Syracuse, New York. A man who spent 16 years in prison after he was wrongfully convicted of raping writer Alice Siebold when she was a Syracuse University student has settled a lawsuit against New York State for $5.5 million, his lawyer said Monday. The settlement comes after Anthony Broadwater's conviction for raping Siebold in 1981 was overturned in 2021. It was signed last week by lawyers for Broadwater and New York Attorney General Letitia James, said David Hammond, one of Broadwater's attorneys. Broadwater, 62, said in a statement relayed by Hammond, quote, "I appreciate what Attorney General James has done, and I hope and pray that others in my situation can achieve the same measure of justice. We all suffer from destroyed lives." Siebold was an 18-year-old student at Syracuse when she was raped in a park near campus in May of 1981. She described the attack and the ensuing prosecution in a memoir, Lucky, published in 1999. Siebold, who is white, wrote in Lucky that she spotted a black man in the streets after being raped and was sure that he was her attacker. Police arrested Broadwater, who was given the pseudonym Gregory Madison in Lucky, but Siebold failed to identify him in a police lineup, picking a different man as her attacker. Broadwater was nonetheless tried and convicted in 1982 after Siebold identified him as her rapist on the witness stand.